You're connected to WebTalk at WebTalkRadio.com, and this is the week of November 6, 2004. And my name is Rob Greenlee, and thank you for checking us out from all over the world. We keep you plugged into the latest net trends and some of the coolest internet-connected devices and software.
Now, don't check us out too carefully. No.
Well, go to our website.
Okay.
Check us out.
I don't want you checking out Rob. He's off limits. This is Dana Greenlee. Thank you very much for joining us. And Rob, we have someone else here with us.
We do have Mitch Ratcliffe in the studio with us, a technology pundit and wild man. He's notorious on our show.
Yes, and I feel very wild today. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you, America, for giving me the shaft.
He's in a very depressed
America
mood.
America has spoken, I hear.
No.
51% of us have voted for extremism.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry. We're not going to get into the politics.
Well,
I know there are people
out there talk
offended
a little bit about
by
it.
The politics,
yeah.
And I don't want to go off on them.
Well, now, does having 48% of the people hate you make you victorious?
Well, I don't call that a mandate, but let's not get into it.
No, right.
Okay. Mitch writes a blog at the Red Herring at redherring.com, and it's called The Now, and go check it out. And he also writes at radcliffeblog.com, too, plus what? A handful of other places as well.
A handful of other places.
Yes, that's right.
Radcliffe Blog is also where he posts pictures of his office, so if you want to see where creative genius occurs, check it out.
That wouldn't be my office.
And Mitch is going to stay with us for the first half of the show. And it's been a busy week here in the United States with the presidential election. And it's finished up, but it was so busy online, it about crashed half of the websites on the internet. Even the WebTalk radio show website shot up in traffic. I don't know why we're not known as a political blog or anything like that, but it just seemed like everybody was online.
A reliable source of entertaining information about technology and occasionally, especially when I'm around.
Politics. Yeah,
because we just argue and bitch and moan about it.
And
James Spader, but we're not going there.
No.
The last time that I saw my traffic climb that quickly was during September 11th, 2001, when the World Trade Center was bombed for some reason. So it spiked at that time, too. That was the last time I saw it spike like
because,
that.
Because, you're also a source of interesting and entertaining information about terrorists.
About terrorists, yeah. Well, thanks to you, Mitch.
Thank you.
Yeah. And actually, I also heard some other interesting things, too, being said in the news about the whole presidential election. Actually, I heard it on CNN. It's called Postpartisan Blues, and there's about 48% of the U.S. and 70% around the world that I think are going through that a little bit right now.
I can hear the harmonicas now.
I got them postpartisan blues.
And it's fairly safe that there's a lot of webloggers out there that are feeling this way.
48% of me wants to move to Canada. Postpartisan blues.
Yeah, and it's amazing how fast the Democrats can go from being really pretty much on the top of the world, man. At the very beginning of the election, John Kerry looked like he was going to win it all. But then now even they're saying that Democrats may be a dying breed. What do you think about that, Mitch?
Oh, that happens after every election. Whichever party loses ends up, being a dying breed. But, it is true that the Democrats have an awful lot of work to do in trying to explain what they really believe to the American people.
Yeah, and on top of that, I've even heard some liberals say online that they're going to band together and secede from the Union. And there's actually talk of a couple of countries, like one of them is United States of Canada. And actually, there's some websites we're going to link to online. And then the Republic of Cascadia
are
the two that I've heard about, all the coasts, since they all seem to be up against Canada.
No, I'm just staying.
No.
A lot of the people I know have been writing and saying, it's time to expatriate and all this. And I've really thought about this.
Yeah.
And
it's
love the country. You want to make it better. You don't
run
off.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this is all just a reaction to losing. So
what bothers me is this proclamation that we are a country of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not just one faith in this country. And how could you be a country of faith when you've got so many differing opinions about it? And the other thing is that sort of exiles from citizenship everybody who has no faith in God.
Well, and also
– which is so antithetical to the American tradition.
Well, and I'm a very –
I was listening to National Public Radio on the way over, and they were talking about the evangelical church has risen up. This was a sermon being given, it's just –
And
it makes me feel bad because I'm a Christian and I've always been from the moment I was born, and I'm a liberal. Does that make me feel
not until you were baptized?
I was baptized at 13. You're right, And I feel like am I not allowed to be part of the, you know, a liberal and Christian?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big issue is there shouldn't be a difference between being liberal and being Christian or being religious. So anyway.
There shouldn't be a difference between Americans. And one of the things that conservatives have done very well is, you know, they'll appoint anybody of any color as mm-hmm. long as they're, you know, share very limited views of the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Bush administration has more high-level black people and Hispanic people than anybody else. But that doesn't mean those people are representative of mm-hmm. black or Hispanic people. Mm-hmm. It means they're representative of a conservative mindset.
Yeah, I'm really feeling that I think that the country can pull together here and move forward and really make some better decisions in the long run. And I've seen some glimpses in George Bush of some of those type of things, but we shall see. On the show this week, we're going to spend most of our time talking about the
glimpses of what?
Of possibilities.
Hope.
Of possibility.
He said today in his press conference that he would reach out to people who share his goals.
Well, wow.
That's not reaching out. That's saying, let's join hands and shout out everybody else.
Okay.
I did get a little heartbeat when he said that in I accept the presidency speech. When he said, I'm talking to you.
Yeah, he said that. But, you know, the thing is, he says, and we have a history that binds us. Now, binds is different than unites. Binds says there's a way we're going to go, and if you don't want to go with us, then you're out. Mm-hmm. And now think about it. What is the one movie series that has dominated the Bush 2 era? The Lord of the Rings. And what is the phrase from that? One ring to rule them all, one ring to bring them to, you know, and one to bind them.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the choice of words that binds us, that's a very, very different meaning than, you know, what I would have chosen to say, which is unites us.
That just
we
means
pull together around our history, whereas, you know, we're just sort of stuck together, and you're going to do as I say because I won the election.
Yeah. Well,
but we're ranting about Bush, and I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, people. But, you know, the thing is, the ideas that we're expressing on the internet right now are going to be limited. You're waiting to get Howard Stern on Sirius because they're not FCC regulated. You just watch. If he's shooting his mouth off about Bush, they're going to shut him down.
There's nothing to stop those satellite radio broadcasts from being regulated in reality. So we shall see.
Howard would never go for Bush versus, you know, the bikini-clad lesbians. I think that's always going to be his first choice.
If all he talked about was bikini-clad lesbians, the Bush administration would leave him completely alone.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well,
hey, he's making money. Great. People who make money are good people.
This is actually a really good segue to a lot of what we're going to talk about on the show this week. Is the semantic web and how data on the internet and the network is going to be able to be accessed through a variety of ways using technology to actually use smart agents and do all sorts of cool things to allow us to get to our information and our stuff a little bit easier.
And this week on the show, we're going to be talking about
why Wired has decided to drop the capital I in the word internet.
Did the political bloggers get a black eye over the exit poll numbers?
Will popular web bloggers be cashing in soon?
Digital Pixel Beauty Contest is coming to the web at missdigitalworld.com.
Well, as Rob said, the concept of the semantic web that is being pioneered by the father of the internet, that's Tim Berners-Lee, will make all of our computing lives easier as smarter software agents will help process and filter the information that we get inundated constantly with and also be able to kind of figure out the meaning of words coming into our computing devices. One of the first frontiers of the semantic web is the next generation internet search technology. Later on the show, we'll talk with Oren Etzioni. He's associate professor at the University of Washington. He's co-founder of the first Metacrawler and webcrawler.com, and he's also a venture partner at Madrona Venture Group. He'll talk about his current semantic web project. He calls it Know It All and the future of the semantic web.
The semantic web would be science fiction if it wasn't for the fact that Tim Berners-Lee conceived of it. He conceived of something that seemed like science fiction. We're all the beneficiaries of, so you have to take it very seriously. The theme of our work in the semantic web is how do you make this great vision real, as opposed to Tim Berners-Lee's fantasy. A lot of people are working, assuming that the semantic web is already real. How do you solve the following small technical problem? And our question is, how do you make it real? And one very important path to making it real is taking the web as it exists today and extracting all the good stuff, all the content that's in there, or at least as much of it as we can, and mapping it to the semantic web so it's machine understandable. Well, there's a number of ways to do that, but one of the primary ways of doing that is to use an information extraction system like Know-It-All to do exactly that. So we've been extracting information and then using the extraction information, storing it in a large database as opposed to, say, annotating people's web pages with metadata. You know, that's because we don't have the permission to do it. But it is very much, you know, en route to creating the semantic web.
Hang with us. Coming right up, we'll talk about all the news and trends that happened this week and that conversation about the semantic web later in the show. And, of course, you're listening to Web Talk Radio.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous. Shoot.
Ooh. How you doing, baby?
Shoot.
No, not you.
Shoot.
The bow-legged one. Yeah.
You're back with Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and I've got Dana Greenlee in here and Mitch Radcliffe. Let's talk about Wired's recent decision to drop the capital I in the letter internet.
Well, you know,
do we
think
that that's a significant development? I know that Wired made that decision probably about a month and a half ago. But
well, you know, the thing is, Wired is the one who sort of, you know, made intercap I's popular in the first place. And I suppose all they're trying to do is just sort of show that they're still ahead of a trend.
Mm-hmm.
But the internet, when they first capitalized it, was a place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very literal place. People had to go. In fact, you had to travel through slow modems to get there. And I think all we're really seeing is that, and they explain it pretty well, is that this is just another medium.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're not saying is, you know, we screwed up by trying to turn it into a fetish 10 years ago. So now we're backing up and we're going to make it right.
Well, in some ways, it's almost making a statement that somehow it's
a fetish in the sense of an object that one carries or
oh, that
worships.
Kind of fetish, not a shoes. Or
yeah, it's also
not a sexual thing, Dana. Would you like to talk about James Spader for a minute?
Well, and I think also it makes a statement that maybe the internet isn't as important as it was back in the early years of its development.
It's more important.
That's basically what it tells me, though. But I think it's also following more commonly used grammar, too, probably.
Well, it's like the radio now or television, yeah. Which is, you know, what
shouldn't
Wired
be always
said.
Capitalized. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I don't agree that web should not be capitalized because World Wide Web is a formal phrase, and if you're going to drop the first two words of it and still use web, it should be capitalized.
And net is another one that they went from uppercase to lowercase as well. I think this isn't necessarily a bad thing. I'd rather type it out normally. It looks kind of funny on the page anyway.
A great deal of people just type in lowercase anyway with no punctuation, so it just really makes them feel more mainstream.
And the other big development that came out of this past week is the whole area of whether or not political bloggers kind of got a black eye over exit poll numbers by putting those numbers on their weblogs. And I heard a lot of the media talk about this and say that that those exit poll numbers really gave a false impression to the to both of the campaigns and also may have potentially damaged the early part of the election in giving people the impression that the wrong person was in the lead at that point. I don't know.
Well,
what's
there's
your thought on
wrong
that?
Wrong with giving the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were reporting something that was, you know, being
changes.
Circulated. Well, and that was being circulated to a closed group of people in
mm-hmm.
the campaigns and elsewhere. Because the campaigns were seeing that stuff. It's not like we, you know,
oh, yeah.
bloggers were confusing the campaigns. It was the other way around. Bloggers were passing along information that was confusing the campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, yeah, it made a lot of us feel like, wow, things aren't going so bad. But then it turned out they didn't. And that may lower the sense that there's credibility with those bloggers. And, yeah, they could pay the price for that. But I don't think that it was wrong for them to mm-hmm. say, you know, we know this is out there.
Yeah. Well, I think that they actually shared them. And I actually put it on my blog as well. I captured some numbers from Slate, I think was the one of the core places that was publishing it online, as well as Matt Drudge, actually. Those two websites, I think,
and
fueled
Matt Drudge
some of that.
And Matt Drudge doesn't have a credibility problem
well,
already?
No, that's true. That's true. He leans toward the right-hand side of the fence a little bit.
Yes, Mitch, leans. I think he leans over.
Were you blogging on election night? Did you kind
of
put stuff out
bit.
There?
Hmm. I published on something having to do with Osama bin Laden's economic attack on the United States, and I was actually dealing with real questions about, you know, like Bush policy, and was, if you're going to have a guy attacking our economy, why would you be giving tax cuts? And then later in the evening, I, you know, blogged on the fact that the Democrats were going to lose, and it really was time to start working hard rather than just say, well, you know, see you next election cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a danger that the blogs lost some credibility with them posting those.
I don't know. The other one I did was I blogged about the Ohio provisional ballots, and I grabbed the video off CNN of the interview with their Secretary of State, which was interesting, and just said, you know, this is just kind of odd that they are going to take 10 days to count this.
11 days. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was odd, too.
And, you know, his answer was, that's just the way it's been done. We have a process.
And, you know, the thing is, the process is a good thing. A lot of people talk about the debacle of 2000. The process at least held up. It didn't necessarily produce the response or the answer everybody wanted, but it did hold up. I mean, we didn't descend into gunfire to determine who was going to hold the White House.
That's true. That's true. I think it went off really well, I think, this year. One of the other big things that have been kind of flying around the whole weblog space, and I know Mitch has been heavily involved in this, is how weblogs and the creators and the content producers on those weblogs are going to be making money here. There's been a lot of discussion over business models and how to put some money in the pockets of some of the more popular weblogs and what the most ethical way of doing that is.
So they can stay in their pajamas.
Yes, that's right.
All day long.
What's your thought on that, Mitch?
Well, you know, I mean, I was contacted by Mark Cantor, who started some of this with a posting saying he wanted to pay bloggers to talk about products, which is probably completely unethical. I mean, if I, you know, called you up and said, I'd like to pay you some sum of money to talk about my product, a lot of people hear, well, then I want you to flog my product mercilessly, and that's really not the way to put it out there. And that actually wasn't what Mark meant. And, you know, for full disclosure purposes, I have been working with Mark to try to get it down to what he did mean. And what he's proposing and what people like Jason Kalkanis of Weblog Incorporated oppose is that bloggers be sponsored for a flat fee of $1,000 a month, as long as they put a badge on the site that says, mm-hmm. you know, this is sponsored by the company that Mark is working with, mm-hmm. and once a week, say, in a text posting, you know, within the body of the blog, you know, thanks very much to Marquee Corp, which is the company that's doing this thing, mm-hmm. for sponsoring my blog. And if they want to say something positive or negative about the product, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a little different than flog my product mercilessly. Now, on the other hand, the company, no company in their right mind is going to want to pay for people just to mercilessly beat them down and say, you know, this product is crap and I hate it and, you know, all that. So it's a limited agreement, 3 months. And mm-hmm. they'll renew if they get even constructive criticism of their product because, you know, that's good for product development.
Yeah.
Now, Jason Kalkanis of Weblogs Incorporated has this more mainstream publishing model where he's building sites and hiring bloggers to staff them and then selling advertising. The model Mark proposes kind of threatens the idea of aggregating blogs. It suggests that you're going to have a lot of people out there who are taking fees and living in their pajamas and, you know, doing what Dana was joking about. But, you know,
pajama bloggers, it's famous.
But basically are, you know, spending all their time doing their blogging and making a few $1,000s a month doing it, or a lot of money. It doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, there's always somebody who does somewhat well and people who do very well. So I think we're just looking at a lot of different models for how you make money as a weblogger, and we haven't got one that's going to dominate. A lot of the argument that I think has happened in the last couple of weeks is between a new idea or a different idea about how you would compensate people and this kind of mainstream publishing model, which, you know, Jason does very well, and so I think he'll be successful too. It's not like one or the other of these is going to win, you know.
Well, and also where does the whole area of journalism come into play in all this? I mean, is this only going to be under the jurisdiction of sites that put themselves out as journalistic sites? Or
no,
it could be any site.
I know one of the sites that Mark wants to get on is Rage Boys, Chris Locke's site, which is not at all about anything having to do with the product. But, you know, I mean, it's crazy and people read it.
Mm-hmm. Is there a room for product placement like you see in the movies? I mean, if you had a video blog or something. Or just talk about,
that's where Kalkanis has a point. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you don't know that you're drinking that Coke because you're being paid to, and I'm watching the site and, you know, thinking about James Spader and watching you, and you're drinking a Coke and wearing a Nike shirt, and for some reason you keep pulling up your Converse socks, you know, I mean, that's going to quickly begin to get old. And I'm going to say, you know, this is not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the question of – it's not journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because journalism purports to be a unbiased record of events.
Well, know, I think for, that whole definition of journalism is blurred right now. You start looking at how the media is now.
Some journalists are blogging and some bloggers are journalisting and, you know.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, is
but not all bloggers are doing either or both of those things.
I mean, is Matt Drudge a journalist? I'm not sure.
No, he's not. He's a
I mean, he's a pundit.
He's a gossip columnist.
I mean, he's a pundit.
He's a gossip columnist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, a pundit is a person who expresses opinions, and he says, I know what the inside scoop is. I mean, so if you really want to break it down, he's Herb Cain, who, you know, in the San Francisco Chronicle and wrote about what was going on at the party last night at the big, you know, down at the mayor's house and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's one type of thing. And you could certainly see, you know, in fact, he is sponsored. But the question about is this journalism or not? Well, journalism is sponsored too.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that journalists are isolated by an editorial infrastructure from the money.
Unless they work at Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but the thing is the blogger is not, because the blogger takes the check. The blogger is painfully aware of whose influence they want to at least, you know, continue to feel good about. Because if the checks stop, then they don't have the blog. And that's a good point. You can't claim to be unaffected in the way that a journalist in an organization with a Chinese wall, is what they call it, between editorial and sales.
It's like the separation of church and state that's
bad. Falling down now.
Yeah. But I know that's a whole other topic here. But, yeah, it's keeping those two worlds separate. Yeah.
And so there is the question is whether or not there are two worlds when you're inside a blogger's head.
Mm-hmm.
And we know there isn't. And being honest
people
about
have opinions on things. Yeah.
And being honest about that and saying, you know, I'm receiving money is an important part of, you know, being ethical, whether or not you're a journalist or not. And I started this a couple of years ago when I noticed that somebody said, you know, Microsoft paid my way to this conference, so I'm blogging about their stuff. And they gave me some hardware and I met Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Thing is, no journalist in their right mind would go do that and then write about the products favorably, which was what this person was doing, saying this is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
That was unethical because it was undisclosed. I found out, you know, somebody else mentioned they had gone on Microsoft's dime, and then I found out who else went because there was a picture of the bloggers.
Yeah.
You know? And I said, well, there's the guy who's raving about Microsoft. After he went on this trip, and he didn't disclose it.
You made a connection there. I think that happened like 2 years ago, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember hearing about it.
So, I mean, we're in the midst of a change, but it's not like we're going to throw away journalism or that we're going to embrace yellow journalism, which is, you know, where everybody has an axe to grind.
But it seems like journalism now is becoming more opinion all the time. I mean, even a site like paidcontent.org, you know, he throws in opinions in with his posts in there, and he's viewed as a journalistic site. So
I think that's
commentary and news reporting are blending together in the blog space.
I agree. And it's happening everywhere. I mean, you know, you mentioned Fox earlier. Fox is unabashedly about blending news and commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, everyone in the mainstream media is increasingly about that because there's less money to have pure journalists and commentators in the first place.
You can't have both.
And there's an overriding desire for there to be some sort of entertainment or controversy to talk about. So even very blasé stories somehow become charged with opinion.
Well, because that's going to drive ratings or traffic in the case of a blog, and that generates more sponsorship.
Well, you know, William S. Paley, who built the CBS News Network, would not give a damn. Although he, of course, at the end of the day, made more money on news than anybody else in the business.
Well, because he was probably more credible at that time, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's also another phenomenon going on online right now, too, and it's all revolving around 3D and graphic creation of avatars. And there's a new beauty contest that's being started. It's at MissDigitalWorld.com, and it's basically a digital beauty contest. And this is kind of interesting, but I think it's really a sign of the evolution of the processing power that we have and the software to create objects or almost digital people, really, is what we're talking about here, and how that's all
models
developing.
Models don't like to be called objects, just for the record.
Well,
neither do airline flight attendants.
Yeah. These particular avatars, or digital models, as they're calling it, they're actually naming them. They're giving them heights, weight, and a polygon count. So it's
what's a polygon?
Polygon is a geometric object used in
faceted three-dimensional
surfaces.
And like,
I'm looking aghast at him right now.
Like one of these models has like 48,200 little polygons.
Is that somehow like a good thing?
I think it'll be interesting. That polygon count may be sort of passé once The Incredibles, the new Pixar film, comes out, which is supposed to be very, very high definition in terms, especially the rendering of skin.
Mm-hmm. Are you getting paid for that?
No, I'm not.
I
that's what everybody's talking about. I heard a very interesting thing that they actually have taken those characters and built them from the bones up so that there's a musculature, and the musculature is moving independently of the skin, you know, the way that, strangely enough, our musculature does, whereas most, you know, avatars are a surface that's drawn. This is a surface that's reacting to something happening underneath it.
Very realistic. So I would say that all actors like James Spader might be quaking in their boots right now.
No, you know what actors are going to have happen ultimately is somebody's going to offer to license their likeness so that they can do no work and get paid.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's coming very quickly, I think.
But, you know, the thing is, in the long term, they're going to be making less money than if they actually did the acting.
But they can relax and have their margarita.
Oh, yeah,
they don't actually have to
act. Dinner theater.
Well, I think it'll all be voiceover, right? Is that basically what you're saying? Is that it'll basically be their voice?
No. Ultimately, their voice will be digitized.
Well, it will be digitized as well. Yeah. So they won't need to do anything.
And there'll be a guy who's, you know, like typing anguished tone, and then, you know, Jack Nicholson goes, out of the computer.
That's not really like interesting.
You can make Jack Nicholson make that sound by sticking a knife into his kidney and then turning it. And you go, but you don't need to do that to Jack.
Or perhaps bashing him with an iron.
Well, and, you know. There's a lot of talk about these avatars being used in pornographic digital things online.
It's certainly safer sex than what currently produces pornography.
Do you remember Brainstorm, that Christopher Walken movie from like 20 years ago, where you just throw on the little headset and you could – okay.
Oh, was that –
I'm talking
thinking of scanners because I thought, doesn't his head blow up at the end?
But – you can go to this website and check it out. It's at MissDigitalWorld.com.
That's MissDigitalWorld.com.
And you can actually vote for your favorite
object model.
I used to run a trade show and executive conference called Digital World, but I don't ever remember Miss Digital World.
Well, that's something new.
They ripped you off.
Yeah. Well, go check it out.
If they had been Tyra Banks, that would have been okay.
Well, I'm sure they're going to make one digital out of Tyra Banks, probably.
I am sure she'll be happy to license her likeness.
You can probably do amazing things with.
Oh, no. See, that's just getting into really scary territory.
I know. I agree. But that's where it's going.
Poor ladies.
You know that's where it's going.
Yeah. And, you know, then you're going to put your helmet on and you're going to be able to do all sorts of things with Tyra. And she's going to be sitting at home thinking, I wonder why I got this money. And then she's going to find out exactly how humiliating what her avatar did to get that money was.
Yeah.
God, you know, it's, and you think about it that way.
That's just scary.
And one of these models.
Now, excuse me while I go take care of James Spader.
Working assets. Actually, it says right in this model.
Rob, you're
working
never going to get
assets.
The headset offer.
I won't. Exactly. Is she has a working asset. Her mouth is sexy, although big.
Working what?
A working asset.
Oh, I didn't hear the
Oh, you didn't hear the asset part. So you know where this stuff is going. So anyway.
Yeah. The other thing is they treat women and her personality plus is she's clumsily funny and sometimes cocky. You know, I just don't get the
I'm not quite sure what that is.
The man who programmed her name is Kaya, whose height is 5'5" and she weighs 121 pounds with 48,200 polygons.
And is born in Brazil.
Sao Paulo.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, I don't think that the manager, Alsue Baptistao, really respects Kaya.
Well, I think he appreciates his work.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Like alone at night.
It's probably his dream girl.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Well, Mitch, thanks for joining us.
By the way,
Alsue, again.
If you're going to send me a hate letter, we are going to read it on the air.
That's right. That's right. If you have to send it to me at rob@webtalkradio.com.
Or just go to Radcliffe blog and just post it.
Just
right
spam
there.
Him.
I'm going to end up like Theo Van Gogh, who gets stabbed in the middle of a street somewhere because he said something nasty about a geek.
You have no idea.
Oh, I will announce a fatwa against this bastard.
Don't even give him ideas.
Well, Mitch, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Thank you.
You've been wonderful.
Thank you.
Stay with us because up next, we'll be recovering from Mitch and talking to Oren Etzioni, associate professor of the University of Washington. He's the co-founder of the very first The Metacrawler and also webcrawler.com. He's also a venture partner from Madrona Venture Group. He'll talk to us about the semantic web project he's working on called Know It All. You won't want to miss it.
This is Web Talk Radio.
Grab a board and surf the web with those crazy web talk guys right here, right now.
Welcome back to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com. And my name is Rob Greenlee. And Dana Greenlee's in here with me.
And you probably have heard of this term, semantic web. Well, the concept of the semantic web, which was pioneered by the father of the internet, that's Tim Berners-Lee, will make all our computing lives a lot easier because we'll have smarter software agents that will hopefully process and filter web information based on its meaning. And that comes to us through our computing devices. One of the first frontiers for the semantic web is the next generation internet search technology.
Yeah, we are lucky to have with us Oren Etzioni, who's the associate professor at the University of Washington and is co-founder of the first Metacrawler and webcrawler.com and is also a venture partner at Madrona Ventures Group. And he's going to talk to us about his current semantic web search project called Know It All and the future of the semantic web. Oren, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob.
You helped build a search engine a long time ago back in the, I think it was the early 90s or so, called Metacrawler. Why don't you take us back a few years and kind of tell us about some of the search projects that you've worked on and, you know, and some of the companies you've helped start, just to kind of give a baseline on your background.
Back in 1994 and 1995, which in internet time seems like centuries ago, there was a large number of search engines. This is before there was Google, but there was AltaVista and Yahoo and OpenText and Galaxy, all kinds of search engines that have gone by the wayside. And they were a lot more flaky than today's search engines. They covered less of the web. They weren't always up, and they didn't always have the features that you wanted. And my graduate student, Eric Selberg, and I had the idea, what if you could build a meta search engine whose job was to search the search engines for you? Mm-hmm. So when you had a query, people would go to one search engine, they'd go to Lycos, they wouldn't find it there, they'd go to Yahoo, Yahoo would be down, and so on and so on. So we had the idea.
Yahoo's down. Why did that happen a lot back then?
You know, we didn't keep accurate statistics, but for example, WebCrawler, which was developed by Brian Pinkerton in our department, was just sitting on one machine in some basement somewhere, and when he'd have to move it, he would just shut it down and carry it across.
Oh,
so,
okay.
It's definitely the case that there was quite a bit of downtime in those very early days.
Now, that was back like in 95? 94, something
yeah,
like that?
This is 94, 95. Yeah. We started working on Metacrawler in 95.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was you would issue your query once, and Metacrawler on your behalf would go to all these search engines. We searched as many as 12. It would go to them in parallel and then bring back the results and create a unified and comprehensive report of, okay, here's what you have at each of the search engines. And in fact, when the search engines would agree, it would boost those results. It would say, well, if three search engines return this page, it must be very important.
Sure.
So we did that. Obviously, that's a lot less necessary today when we have Google that's obviously a lot more reliable, running quickly, and producing high-quality results. It's an interesting question for the future, though. what's going to happen as more and more search engines come online to give Google a run for its money, and as the web increases to grow in size, will there become another time in the future where it would make sense again to have a meta search engine that combines the results of the different search engines? And that's an open mm-hmm. question for the future.
Sure.
Now, you did your work on meta or web crawler also at the University of Washington. Why don't you talk about how it is to be an academic and to invent things of such import?
So web crawler was done by Brian Pickerton, who is a student here, but I have to give him all the credit for that. But we've all had the experience of creating something, putting it out there. And again, in the early days of the web, it seemed like all you had to do was put it out there and people would start finding it and telling each other. And our usage was growing, doubling every week. And then the press picked it up. And it's actually a wonderful feeling because I write a lot of rather obscure academic papers, and a very small number of people read those, and the ones who do tell me how boring those papers are or how wrong-headed they are. And that's the kind of dialogue that we have in this very small community. But our goal is very much to have an impact, to have our ideas have an impact on people. And so when we created something and at its peak millions of people per day were using it, it was very exciting, and a lot of the people were sending us very passionate emails saying, this is great, and we think you should add this. And it was a wonderful feeling.
So was that the first search engine, or was that the first meta search engine?
Brian's web crawler was one of the first search engines, and meta crawler was the first major meta search engine out there.
Okay.
And where is Brian these days? Because I hope he's either tenured at the university or
or he's working somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. He went on to become the VP of engineering at Excite, which was another one of these large portal companies that ran a search engine. They ended up acquiring WebCrawler, and so he went on to industry, actually.
Certainly, the search engines have changed quite a bit over the years, and why don't you talk about how metasearch and the search engines that we see today have kind of evolved, and if you can run through kind of perspective of what things were like back then and really how far we've gone in the last 5 or 6 years with search.
Sure. Well, the next step that we took, and a lot of people actually copied us, was to say this notion of metasearch doesn't just need to apply to search engines. Mm-hmm. What about, for example, shopping? So there were more and more stores coming online, right? This was Amazon and mm-hmm. Buy.com, and Barnes & Noble was fighting them. And the idea was, well, could you do comparison shopping equally conveniently using the same idea? So you're looking for a product, mm-hmm. and you want to know who's stocking this product and at what price. So you'd go to your shopping agent. We called it a shop bot, mm-hmm. and issue a query. And it would go to all the stores on your behalf and, again, give you a comprehensive report. And so we ended up spinning out a company out of the University of Washington. It was called NetBot Incorporated. You know, there are all these mm-hmm. names, ShopBot, NetBot. We had SoftBots. Somebody actually wrote an article about us and said that it seems that computer scientists can't figure out where the space bar is on the keyboard because
they all just run together, right? There's
exactly.
No space? Yeah.
Exactly.
I understand.
There's no space in ShopBot. It's one word. Mm-hmm. At any rate, and so what NetBot did was develop the first major comparison shopping engine across a large number of categories of products. And Excite, that I mentioned earlier, ended up buying that company, and Yahoo turned to another company called Zhengli to create their comparison shopping product, and then Amazon bought Zhengli. And quite a few companies created comparison shopping products. There's MySimon, and probably the most recent incarnation, which is actually a pretty impressive product, is Frugal.
Frugal, yeah.
Yeah, frugal.google.com, where, again, that's the place I go to when I buy an expensive product. I want to check prices. When I buy a product like a book that I don't care about, I just go to Amazon because, hey, they have free shipping.
Yeah.
If I care about the price, I'll go to Frugal.
There you go. Yeah, it seems like that whole technology that you built up here originally has kind of made a tour, you know, down south and then back up here again, because it seems like that the, you know, site like the Amazon folks is really not a comparison shopping site per se, even though I think it has some of that functionality now, but it's really a database search engine is really what Amazon is in its core, and they just they put on a transaction piece to it. So it seems like that the kind of the evolution of the projects that you've been working on have kind of led up to where you are kind of with the project today. It seems like you're kind of pulling it together. Why don't you kind of run through for us kind of your current project that you're working on?
What we're doing currently, again, my job at the university is to think ahead. So the question I've been asking myself most recently is not how could we make something a little bit better than Google, because there are very smart people, in fact, people hired, right, our students who've been hired by Google and by Microsoft and by Yahoo, who are working on exactly that problem. So the question I ask myself is, what is search going to look like in 10 years or in 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
Can we build prototype systems that will give us some insight into that? And so my most recent research project is a system called Know-It-All that says, you know what, instead of doing this thing where you type in keywords and you get a bunch of URLs back that point you at documents that you can read, what if you could actually have the computer do some level of reading of the documents on your behalf and extract information from the documents? So let me give a concrete example that illustrates this. Wouldn't it be nice if you could go to an engine and ask it, what are the reviews of the ThinkPad T40 laptop? And get back not a long list of URLs, some of which have reviews, some of which don't, but instead a statement like, I found 2,300 reviews, 85% of which are positive. Well, we actually built a system based on Know-It-All that does exactly that. And the way it works is it issues a query like ThinkPad T40 or ThinkPad T40 reviews, but then it goes through the documents that comes back. It categorizes them as a review or not, and then it takes the ones that are reviews and it analyzes them and says, well, does this look like a positive review? Does it contain adjectives like superb, stupendous, loved it? Or is it, in fact, a negative review saying things like, you know, the hard drive failed and hated it and so on. And by doing that, we're able to at least, we don't get it right every time, but at a course measure, assess whether this is a positive review and how positive, and return that kind of information to the user.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's really more like a smart search engine that really analyzes the information and not just just does a bunch of keyword matching.
That's exactly right. And so if your goal is to say, I don't know, find Toyota.com's homepage or, you know, find that paper, academic paper you heard about and you want to read, a search engine is fine. But if your goal is to collect information that's really present in a large number of web pages, the answer is not on a single web page, but to get the answer, you have to look at a large number of web pages. Well, that's pretty tedious to do yourself. If you can get a program to do it on your behalf, well, that's that much better. One of my favorite sayings is that computer scientists are the laziest people in the world, right? We just try to get the computer to do more and more of the work for us.
Exactly. Well, now, this whole concept that Tim Berners-Lee is kind of pushing out there is the semantic web. And I was reading through your website and reading through some of the white papers that you have going on some of these projects, and I know one of the other projects you're working on is semantic email, which is a whole other topic, I know. But it seems like that these concepts are kind of converging on each other, and what you're building here with this Know-It-All site in search engine technology really kind of incorporates the whole semantic web. Why don't you explain to us a little bit what the semantic web is and maybe how that fits into what you're doing with this search bot?
Sure. Well, the semantic web is a very exciting visionary idea by Tim Berners-Lee of making the content that's on the web not just human-readable with HTML and pictures and so on, but making it machine understandable. So actually machines could go on the web on your behalf, see the content that's out there, understand it and do things to it. So he gives a great example of trying to schedule a physical therapy appointment for his mom and having a computer agent on his behalf figure out, okay, which therapists are listed with the particular insurance that she has and what appointments do they have available and with which therapist and how are those therapists reviewed at various review sites and putting all that information together to come up with an appointment. And that's the kind of thing that the web makes much easier than the old days where you'd have to do this sort of thing by phone. But it's still a slow and tedious process today. Well, in Tim Berners-Lee's vision, you wouldn't have to do anything. Your agent would do this for you. And this vision, I think, most people would dismiss as pure science fiction if it wasn't for the fact that it was Tim Berners-Lee's idea. And last time, yeah, that he had an idea that seemed like science fiction. Well, we all know what happened then.
Yeah.
So everybody in the research community is taking this quite seriously and working on it. Our own focus has been on the question of, okay, the semantic web is hard to build. How are we going to get from the web as it is today, where it's, yeah, you know, textual and pictorial but not machine understandable, to a semantic web? And one of the answers to that is, in fact, something like Know-It-All that processes the current web, extracts information from it that, in machine understandable form. Mm-hmm. So one way to get from here to there, to get from the web to the semantic web, is to use a system like Know-It-All to help create the semantic web.
We're in the middle of a conversation with Oren Etzioni. He's the associate professor at the University of Washington. He's talking about his new semantic web search project called Know-It-All. More with Oren in a second. You're listening to Web Talk Radio.
My favorite shows on TV have 12 minutes of advertising.
I can't get behind that kind of time.
I'm Rob Greenlee, and this is Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com. Dana Greenlee is in here with me, too.
And joining our little trifecta is Oren Etzioni. He's the associate professor at the University of Washington, an early pioneer of the Internet, working on it probably for the last 10 or so years. He's co-founder of the first Metacrawler and webcrawler.com. He's also a venture partner at Madrona Venture Group, funded in part by, I believe, Howard Schultz of Starbucks fame. He's talking about the semantic web and his past and present projects and research.
What type of data are we going to see pulled into this? I mean, is this going to even support audio, video, the XML protocols out there? Is there some other data sources, like maybe some deep search engines or deep databases that aren't currently accessible? Is that the vision of just trying to get access every piece of data that happens to be on a network and really look at the World Wide Web as really just a database that's searched? And what's your thought on that?
Right. Well, Know-It-All is very far from accomplishing anything like that, but mm-hmm. that is very much the vision of the semantic web. And, of course, it presents a lot of problems. For example, my data might be stated in one vocabulary, and your data might be in a different vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And, there might even be confusion. I might be talking about price, and I mean net price, and you would be talking about price, and you mean gross price. Mm-hmm. And so, there can be all kinds of errors there.
So there has to be some standard ways of parsing data. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's very hard to come up with standard ways to understand data, because effectively what you're saying is we're going to come up with a standard way to talk about everything that there is. Probably what's more likely to happen is to have methods of translating between one way of talking about data and the other. And my colleague Alon Halevi and his student has been for many years working on what's called schema matching and information integration, which is very much this essential problem. Another essential problem for the semantic web to be real is how can we build systems that automatically translate between one vocabulary and another.
Oh, okay. You have this whole challenge of language, too, I would think, is it really complicates it. And I would think it would require just huge processing capacity in order to really do the semantic web effectively, I would think.
It is an issue of multiple languages. And again, there's a very vibrant field of automatic machine translation that's mm-hmm. that's working on that. Computing power is definitely a part of this. Okay, we're doing all kinds of things at a massive scale, computing statistics, for example, over hundreds of millions of documents, which we couldn't do before. But I sometimes think that people overemphasize, everybody loves Moore's Law, and it's very easy to understand how hardware just keeps getting faster and faster. To some extent, that means that we've got more and more realistic games on our Xboxes. Some of the problems that we work on, even if machines were 1,000 times faster tomorrow, we still wouldn't be a lot closer to solving them. Part of the insights that we're trying to generate have to do with very hard conceptual problems that we just need to figure out the right algorithms to solve and the right representation.
Yeah, I would certainly think that that's really what you're really working on, is ways of looking at data and parsing it and building meaning around it, I would think.
That's exactly right. How do we get from text, from data that people can understand, to something that where the meaning is explicit so that a literal-minded computer can understand it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the whole concept of a semantic web, and it really sounds exciting because what it will enable us to do, it sounds like from what you're saying, is that be able to simplify how we gather and share data online, from our scheduling of appointments to finding information just be delivered to us versus us having to hunt for it and search for it all the time.
That's exactly right. So an example of what you're saying, some of the work we've done is to generalize Tim Berners-Lee's notion of the semantic web to encompass the realm of email. Number one email annoyance is spam, right? We all know about that and working to get rid of it. The second email annoyance is all those little messages which aren't spam, which means you have to answer them, not just delete them, but they're really mechanical. People asking me for directions to my house. They're asking me, what am I bringing to the potluck? Can they get a copy of this particular paper for me? There's many, many emails that I get that I wish that I had, again, an agent that could process them automatically. So work that actually Alain Halevi and I and a graduate student, Luke McDowell, have done is looked at how can we broaden the semantic web so that we start having semantic email where people are able to state their questions or their queries in ways that an automatic agent can answer and can manage the interactions. Let me give you another example, maybe a better example. Let's suppose you have some baseball tickets to give away. The way this is usually done in an office environment, someone will send a message to 50 people, say, I got a couple of baseball tickets for tonight. I can't go. Who's interested? And then they'll get, 35 emails saying, I want it. And then they'll have to send another message saying, okay, stop emailing me. I already gave them away, 5 minutes after my message. It'd be much better to just have a semantic email process that says, here, I've got this many tickets. Okay. Now you talk to my semantic email program if you want the tickets, and I'm not going to be involved anymore. And other people who are not interested are not going to get these broadcasts. I've got the tickets. I don't have the tickets.
It's a great way to deflect the responsibility, right? I didn't make the decision. The software agent made the decision.
That's right. It's on a first come and on a first come first serve basis, right? It has all kinds of benefits. Or another one, I get in my email, tons of reminders to mailing lists, like the faculty mailing list. Don't forget to come to this. Don't forget to send us that. And what's annoying about that is I try to be conscientious, and half the time those reminders don't apply to me because I've already done it, but they're still getting broadcast. Sure. So again, if you had an agent issuing the reminders, the agent could keep track of who's already responded and who didn't, and only send reminders to the people who deserve them.
Yeah. So are we seeing some of these type of functions already starting to be deployed online? I mean, I was thinking about a couple of them that are kind of simple examples, but, like Plaxo, I don't know if you're familiar with that software program that basically shares, your email address and your contact.
Yes, yes.
And then also Google News.
Alerts.
Yeah, has a program that will actually send you search results. So are those kind of crude examples of what the semantic web could be?
Well, the Google News Alerts is really just a search feature, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of engines, search engine various sorts, have keyword-based alerting features where if some keyword is matched, it'll send you an alert. Mm-hmm. And that's useful, but not particularly semantic or ambitious. Okay. When you start talking about things like Plaxo or I forget the names of some of the other programs. When you start talking about some of these programs that help you manage and update your contacts, or Evites is an example, helping to manage invitations and so on, these are starting to be small applications of the idea of the semantic web or of semantic email. Typically, these are very hard-coded and very limited. Mm-hmm. So at the university, we're exploring much more ambitious and much more general versions of these. But yeah, those are the inklings, right, the harbingers of a more semantic kind of interaction.
What needs to happen to the web to enable this to really take off?
I think that's a great question. I think that what the semantic web needs is a killer app. So the tools for making the semantic web come about, at least for technical people, are coming online. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, for example, why don't I put any semantic metadata associated with my homepage, where I list a bunch of information? The answer is, what's the point? Mm-hmm. If I do that, nothing's going to happen. Nobody's going to consume or use that information.
Yeah.
So one of the central ideas of our work is to create a situation where the benefit of creating the semantic web exceeds the cost of creating the semantic web. And that equation has two pieces. One is drive the cost down, right? right? And the other one is increase the benefit. And at that point, you get the benefit exceeds the cost. Mm-hmm. So we've been good at driving the cost down. But as a community, what we haven't yet done is come up with a killer app that gets everybody doing it. You know, Napster is an example, right? Mosaic at a time was an example, right? The web existed long before people started using it en masse because there wasn't a graphical browser.
Sure.
So I think what the semantic web is waiting for is a killer app.
Would that be search, do you think? Is that why you're putting so much of a push in that area?
That's a possibility. I don't know. Definitely improving search is a possibility, although people are pretty happy with Google. I think it's very hard to anticipate these things a priori. That's one of the reasons my job is so exciting. I have my ideas, but then I have a whole set of young people with their own great ideas coming in here and keeping me on my toes. So I think the best ideas come from young students, and I don't know them yet.
Okay. What other ideas out there could be created, do you think, to really inspire people to accept and embrace this technology rapidly?
That's a good question.
You're not sure?
That's a good answer for.
Okay.
We need these killer apps, and I don't have one.
Where are we going to see it happen first, do you think?
Well, there is a lot of work in large corporations. Large corporations have always had electronic means for exchanging data. These were using standards that were non-web standards. And my understanding is that large corporations are very actively engaged in making those standards more compatible with semantic web standards, with RDF, XML, and so on. And so I think there is some work there where the motivation is that a CIO decides this is the way to go and issues that edict, and then his or her team is busy making that happen.
Oren, I just love looking into the future. I'm so glad that we were able to sort of glimpse of what's around the horizon. But is there any place right now that anyone listening could go see examples of what you're talking about, websites, or they could play with that technology?
The semantic web technology?
Yeah.
Yes, and Know-It-All.
Well, you know, Know-It-All is not deployed. I would say that we will actually have a clever Know-It-All application in the next few months. So if people are interested, they can send me email or go to my homepage. You can just search for Etzioni. We do have a page at the University of Washington, which is /research/know-it-all. And we have some examples of the sorts of things that Know-It-All has learned. But it's not very useful at all at this point. I think that this stuff is still, you can read about it, but there aren't great applications that where it's ready to be deployed. There is a fun search engine that a colleague of mine has done. It's called Woogle, and that's a search engine for finding web services. Web services are these remote interfaces to code, to programs that are accessible over the web. And so if you search for Woogle, W-O-O-G-L-E, you can find something that's starting to understand. It's not understanding the semantics of documents, but if, for example, you want to find a calendar application or you want to find a zip code application, Woogle is actually an interesting place to go.
Will we see this technology, the semantic web technology, be something that Google starts to push and roll out? What's your vision on that?
My vision of that is that in small ways, they are already doing it. So if you look at Froogle, that's a program that in the arena of products is able to extract information from product pages and make it searchable to you using at least a few attributes. Mm-hmm. If you look at Google Local, you'll see that they have the ability to extract address and phone number information from web pages, and then you can get information that's organized based on that.
Oh, okay.
So I do think that, again, little pieces of semantics are creeping into search engines like Google, but they're doing so in very limited arenas. The full-blown semantic web with the power that Tim Berners-Lee envisioned, I think, is still quite a ways off.
Will we need to ultimately use a different code base to build the content online in order to really do this effectively? And where does the whole really simple syndication activity fit into all this, too?
It sure seems like, particularly on the Internet, every few years you have to redo everything from scratch with the latest technology set. So I'm quite confident saying that a few years from now, you're going to have to redo it all from scratch using the the latest and greatest. As far as really simple syndication and blogs and some of these things, I find myself to be an old curmudgeon on these things. The way I think about everything that comes across my desktop and my inbox is, are you sending me more things or are you giving me less things? Because you have to remember, right, information is exploding, and the sets of beeps and messages and instant messages and messages that we get is just exploding. But our capacity as humans is fixed.
Yeah.
And so, to me, if you are something like a comparison shopping engine that's saving me a bunch of time, I don't have to go to 15 places to get the information I want. You're going to do it for me. If you're something like Know-It-All, you're going to look at 1,000 web pages so I don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're part of the solution. But if you're something that's pushing things at me, like RSS or all these blogs that I have to read, from my point of view, you're part of the problem.
Okay.
So,
well,
I think our goal is to the way I think about my research is, how can we free up people's time so they can be out there hiking or spending time with their kids, or you know, being more productive participants in the economy, not how can we shower them with more and more little tidbits of no value ultimately.
So all those bloggers out there that are priding themselves on being able to monitor 2,200 RSS feeds is not a wise use of time? Is that what you're really trying to say?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Herb Simon, who was one of my mentors at graduate school, had a great line. He said, read a book. He said, what are you doing looking, you know, he passed away, but what are you doing looking at, 2,000 blogs? Read a book. What's the editorial filter? What's the quality? What's the lasting merit of all these blogs when you could pick up a book or pick up even a magazine article or an academic paper that people have put thought and effort into? I think the editorial function, which is exercised by journals and periodicals and even newspapers, is extremely important. So my notion of a blog is I pick up the New York Times op-ed page, right? And I see, what's in there.
Paper?
Yeah, that paper thing, I know. It's very mobile, though, right? I can take it and lie in bed and read it.
Well, it's not going to be too much longer before we have digital paper, it'll actually display all this stuff on a wireless transmission, so you can just take it with you wherever you go. But yeah, it seems like what you're saying is that these smart agents in the semantic web in the future could almost be that editor for you in some ways.
Exactly. They're editors, they're filters.
Yeah.
Less is more. If I can get less information of higher quality, then my life is better. And if I can get more information of lower quality, then my life is worse. And you can apply that criteria, call it Etzioni's razor. You can apply that criteria to every technology that you look at. Is it making more overload or less?
Thank you for joining us. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, we're out of time for the show this week. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it. If you have ideas or people that you want to hear from on the show, please let us know. Go to webtalkradio.com, post to our blog, or send us an email in the form right there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.